Hello, Humanist Network News podcast listeners. This is Jessica.
And this is Duncan. We wanted to give you a heads up for this month. We're doing a special promotional show. We will be attending the International Humanist and Ethical Union World Humanist Congress, which is being held in Washington, D.C. this June 5 through 8. So we're going to be handing out CDs to introduce our program to new listeners.
That's right. Special show this month. We're going to have some clips from all of our past shows. But next month, we're going to have some all new material, hopefully, that we get from this conference.
And if you're like me and you can't stand those like clip shows like the Seinfeld, you know, I always felt it was kind of a cop out. We don't mind if you just tune in next month for all new material.
And speaking of next month, we might actually be recording in our brand new podcast studio.
Yeah, we've been recording in an undisclosed location for several months now, and we're getting kicked out. But thanks to many of our generous donors, we were able to start work constructing a new studio in our offices. And by the way, if you would like to donate to help furnish our new podcast, you can visit our website at humaniststudies.org.
All right. Now, Duncan, you've been doing some research on our growing audience.
Our skyrocketing audience.
That's
yes.
Right.
In the past 8 months, we have had an average monthly listenership of the Humanist Network News podcast of 10,500 people out there. It's pretty cool, huh?
Absolutely. Now, something that listeners can do to help us grow even more is to rate our show or review our show on iTunes.
Yep. We're looking for 50 five-star reviews.
That's right.
So how do people do that? If you listen to our show on iTunes, and I know that there are approximately 2,500 of you doing that, click the music store link in iTunes. Search for the Humanist Network News podcast.
Yep. And then on our store page is sort of to the right-hand side of the page there. It says review the show.
That's the best way to get our show featured in the iTunes store.
Thanks a lot, folks.
Okay, Jess, let's get on with the regular show.
All right.
I ain't afraid.
This is Salman Rushdie.
Hi, this is Julia Sweeney.
This is Theo Wilson.
Hi, this is Dar Williams, and you're listening to the
Humanist Network
Humanist
News.
Network
Humanist
News.
Network News.
Humanist Network News.
I ain't afraid of your Yahweh.
You're listening to the Humanist Network News, an audio production by the Institute for Humanist Studies.
And the official podcast of the American Humanist Association.
I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
And I'm your host, Duncan Crary. We're going to be doing a special program this month to promote the Humanist Network News at the International Humanist and Ethical Union World Humanist Congress, which is being held in Washington, D.C. this June 5 through 8. The World Humanist Congress has been held in France, India, and the Netherlands, and this is the first time that the Congress has been held in the U.S. in the past 20 years, and there are humanists from around the globe attending this event. The sponsors of the World Congress are the International Humanist and Ethical Union, the American Humanist Association, the International Humanist and Ethical Youth Organization, and the Secular Student Alliance. The Institute for Humanist Studies, which produces this program, is a member of the IHEU, a partner of the American Humanist Association, and a grantor of the IHEYO and the Secular Student Alliance. Whew, that's quite a mouthful,
that
Jess.
That is, Duncan. Nicely done.
Okay, so why don't you let some of these folks know what this show is all about, Jess.
Sure. Now, for some of you listening to our program for the first time on an audio CD, Humanist Network News is a monthly audio podcast. Now, don't be intimidated by the word podcast. You do not need an iPod. pretty much, it's just an old-fashioned radio talk show that we broadcast over the internet.
Yeah, don't fear the technology. You can listen to our show anytime online at humaniststudies.org/podcast or americanhumanist.org/podcast. We don't mind which website you prefer to listen to. You can also subscribe to our program using iTunes or another podcatcher program, and your computer will, if you do subscribe that way, your computer will automatically download each new show as it's uploaded.
Now, we've produced 30 podcasts over the past few years. The topic of our show is humanism, which is a worldview based on reason and compassion.
And in each program, we try to explore humanist thought through a variety of topics. On today's show, we're going to be playing clips from previous podcasts that we've recorded. You can hear all of those programs in their entirety on our website. In each show, we try to explore the topic of humanism through a different area like art, music, politics, science, philosophy, pop culture.
And humor.
And humor. Sometimes we try to be funny.
We interview a variety of guests from all around the world, including some celebrities, some humanist activists, and just some everyday folks.
Yeah, actually, Jess, I think a few years ago we went out to the streets and we asked some regular folks what they thought humanism means. So, Jess, let's play that clips. And listeners, we're really sorry about the cheesy music underneath. We cannot get that music off. So just hang tight. Can you tell me, what is humanism?
Humanism? That's a pretty interesting question.
What it is?
I actually learned about this in class, but I forgot and I didn't pay attention.
I would guess that it's something about the act of caring about humans or about the condition of the human existence, something like that.
It's about humanity and man's faith in mankind and belief in mankind.
Humanism is just appreciating the qualities of being human.
Well, more directly, it's anything that is, to me, anti-religious.
Humanism is a non-religious worldview that seeks to maximize human happiness and dignity.
Humanism is a secular philosophy based on reason and compassion that has a particular focus on human dignity and human potential.
A core value of humanism is that men and women can live ethical and moral lives, can live happy and charitable lives, responsible lives, without recourse to supernaturalism, that is, without a belief in God. And we can only understand ourselves and the world around us by employing free inquiry, the scientific method, human imagination, and intelligence.
Those last two speakers were Larry Jones, president of the Institute for Humanist Studies, and Matt Cherry, executive director of the Institute for Humanist Studies.
Yeah, they were cheating. They already knew the answer to the question.
Duncan, tell the listeners about the Institute for Humanist Studies.
Okay. The Institute for Humanist Studies is an international nonprofit think tank that promotes the philosophy of humanism, and we are based in Albany, New York, which is about 140 miles north of New York City, for those of you out of the country wondering where Albany is. The Institute advances human rights, secular ethics, and the separation of religion and government through advocacy, innovation, and collaboration. All of our programs are provided for free, and you can learn all about them at our main website, humaniststudies.org.
Now, the Institute also has a special focus on humanist youth programs. Two programs that IHS funds, Camp Quest and the Secular Student Alliance, are housed in the Institute's headquarters here in Albany, which we call the Humanist Center.
Yeah, it's one big, happy, snug family.
but they're both independent organizations, and IHS, we provide funding and we offer free office space to our neighbors.
Okay, Jess, we've been flapping our gums here for quite a while. Let's get to the fun stuff. Let's hear from Camp Quest.
Sounds good. Now, Camp Quest is a sleepaway summer camp for children of humanist, agnostic, atheist, and free-thinking families.
For the H&N podcast, Amanda Metzkis, president of Camp Quest, interviewed the campers and counselors at Camp Quest last summer. I think this is a lot of fun, so let's roll that clip.
All right.
I really think of myself as an atheist.
Free thinker.
Well, I think I'm a bright and a super because I believe in ghosts, but I don't believe in God.
A combination of atheist and free thinker.
I think of myself as an atheist and free thinker.
I don't know.
I'm not completely sure, but partly atheist, partly Jewish.
What would be in between atheist and agnostic? I don't know if there's a word for that, but if there is, that would be me.
I think of myself as a humanist, but I don't believe in God, but I feel that it's okay if you do.
How do you think of yourself? Do you think of yourself as a humanist, as an atheist, as an agnostic, as a free thinker? As something else, some of the above, all of the above, none of the above?
I'm probably, like,
75% atheist because I still have, like, some superstitions.
Like, what are your superstitions?
Well, I sort of, like, believe that, like, trees can, like, think and stuff.
Well, I sort of call myself a free thinker because I like to think for myself. Mostly atheist, a humanist, and a free thinker because my parents are mostly atheists and humanists.
A humanist.
And what does being a humanist mean to you?
Basically means that I don't believe in any God.
Okay.
It's just like an atheist, except atheists are more serious.
I love those kids. They're so cute.
I know, it's hilarious. I get a kick out of that. Camp Quest has summer camp programs in the United States and Canada, and next year there will be a Camp Quest in the United Kingdom.
That's exciting. You can, you know, find out about this progress from their website, camp-quest.org.
Another humanist youth organization, which is actually one of the organizations hosting the IHEU World Congress this June, is the International Humanist and Ethical Youth Organization.
We've partnered with IHEO to broadcast two programs dedicated to the humanist youth movement around the world. Their first program recorded in Belgium, and then their second program was recorded in India and hosted from Nepal.
Very exotic locations. So let's hear what those humanist youth have to say.
Hello and Namaste. Welcome to the IHEO magazine. This program is prepared for Institute for Humanist Studies, IHS, and IHEO in collaboration with Soch Nepal. We young humanists from Nepal, me Sarada
and me Uttam,
will be with you till next 1 hour.
This whole program is based on the 5th IHEO conference, its activities, news and different views of the participants and experiences. A Norwegian girl, Randy, shares her belief of humanism like this.
I kind of admire the humanists in Asia a lot more than I admire the people in Europe, no offense, but it's like you're so strong in your thoughts about how to help people with the social reforms. You go out to the field to help them, to talk with them. Your mind is so clear about what you want to do, what is necessary. You're structured about it. And in Europe, it's more like it's an individual thing. So we don't have the same fire. For some people, it's kind of hard to stand up and say, hello, I'm a humanist and an atheist. In Norway, it's kind of like, oh, okay. And it's totally respectable and it's acceptable.
What kind of cooperation do we need to develop humanist activity in Norway and in developing country as well?
Yeah.
From these two sides.
Yeah, I believe that in Norway we kind of need this input from the Asian countries to really know what things are about, because some of the people in Norway or Europe kind of think that if the development countries get money, then it's all solved.
Learn more at IHEO.org. That's IHEYO.org.
So Jess, let's switch gears. One of the foundations of humanism is science, of course. And E.O. Wilson is one of the great living biologists of our time.
Mm-hmm.
We had a chance to catch up with him at the New Humanism Conference at Harvard, hosted by our friends at the Humanist Chaplaincy at Harvard.
That's right. Let's hear a little bit of what E.O. Wilson had to say.
I think that religion, or the tendency to form religions of one form or other, is hardwired as a high adaptive Darwinian value, and that you can't just get rid of it. You have to have it evolve, help it evolve into something more based on reason, fairness, and genuine universality based on common interest instead of just promotion of a single particular belief system.
Don't forget, listeners, we're just playing samples of previous programs. You can hear the entire interviews at our website, humanistudies.org/podcast or americanhumanist.org/podcast. This year, the Institute for Humanist Studies took the helm of the Darwin Day celebration, which is an international recognition of Charles Darwin and his theory of evolution. It occurs every year on February 12th, which is his birthday. Each February, we produce a special Darwin Day-themed program.
And this year, we actually got to speak with Matthew Chapman, the great-great-grandson of Charles Darwin.
Matthew Chapman, thank you so much for agreeing to speak with me today.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure.
How long have you known that you're a descendant of Charles Darwin?
Oh, from very early on, from, I would think, about the age of four. Mm-hmm. We lived in Cambridge, England, in fairly academic circles, and it was a matter of kind of pride to be connected to Darwin, but it wasn't in any way controversial or it wasn't that interesting. It was just a sort of a connection to a historical figure whose work had been done and everybody had really moved on.
Mm-hmm. Now, although you have said that you've been an atheist or an agnostic for some 30 years or so, you've also confessed to having been a young zealot, a young religious zealot in your youth. And you read the Bible, you were raised in the Church of England, you prayed. So I'd like to ask you, while you were still a religious child, did you have any conflict regarding your great-great-grandfather's theory of evolution?
None whatsoever. In fact, if I had to say what my image of God was as a child, it would have been a combination of Darwin and Leonardo da Vinci. They were both bald, had big gray beards, and kind of looked wise and kind. I mean, I think they were both very kind men. And when you refer to me as a zealot, I wasn't exactly a zealot. I just wanted to be a saint. That's all. That was my ambition, was to be a saint and do good things. And God and I would go out there and make the world better and happier and more peaceful.
Yeah. Now, have you inherited any family lore about Charles Darwin? Are there any stories about him passed down through the generations? Perhaps maybe these stories have evolved over time that most of us folks wouldn't have heard about Charles Darwin?
Well, there are two things. I mean, I think both of which actually people who know about Darwin would have heard about. One is a suggestion of hypochondria and depression, which are thought, I mean, certainly the depressive aspects of his character are thought to sort of descend down the female line of the Darwin family. And certainly my grandmother and my mother were both very prone to depression. Mm. And then, of course, the hypochondria is always a slight mystery because people don't really know whether it was some disease he picked up on his trip on the Beagle,
yeah,
or whether, in fact, it was, some people suggest that it was an existential guilt that was manifest through his body. I have no idea. I have a little tendency to hypochondria myself. Nobody likes to get sick, you know.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that I think is also known about him, but that I think is very fascinating and relevant to modern times, is that he used to keep a notebook. I think it was a notebook. He used to keep notes on any scrap of information that he found that contradicted his theories, because he said that it was very easy to discard things that were not in line with what you wanted to believe. And so it was important to write down everything so you didn't forget it and didn't discount it. And I think that that kind of intellectual honesty is something that has gone absent in a lot of public life in America.
'Twas adaptive radiation that produced the mighty whale. His hands have grown to flippers, and he has a fishy tail. Selections made him streamline for his liquid habitat. Why didn't I think of that? There was an ancient mammal that could hop and leap around. but with webbing twixt his fingers, he could fly right off the ground. And so this mousy creature evolved into a bat. Why didn't I think of that?
That song at the end there was "Why Didn't I Think of That" by Richard Milner.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, it is. He was Richard Milner was also a guest on our show. We talked to him about doing his musical called Charles Darwin Live and in Concert.
Yeah, he's a great guest to book if you're hosting a Darwin Day event anytime throughout the year. This is going to be the bicentenary celebration of Charles Darwin's birth. That's a mouthful, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Okay, another speaker at the IHEU World Congress this June is going to be Philip Pullman. Philip Pullman is, as you may know, the author of The Golden Compass, which is a children's work of literature that got quite a bit of media attention this year for its possible atheist origins or message. So let's hear what Mr. Pullman had to say.
Well, identifying oneself as anything for a writer, for a novelist, is a perilous thing, because then you find yourself acting as a spokesman for this cause or that cause. I've always tried to avoid saying I am an agnostic, I am an atheist, I am a humanist, I am anything else, because that way you're limiting the way that your books are received, and I don't want to do that. I want people to I want to be a bit more democratic about it and let people discover for themselves what cause is being espoused, if a cause is indeed being espoused. I don't suppose some of my stories do espouse a particular cause. So I've always hesitated, really, before describing myself as anything, and that includes humanist. However, I can tell you when I began to believe that there was probably not any supernatural influence on the course of world events, and that was when I was a teenager, and I began to read a little bit of philosophy that I could understand, and really about science too, and to come to the conclusion that probably the stories I'd been told in church were not actually literally true. So I guess that my lack of religious belief dates from quite a long time ago now, over 40 years.
This is Brendan Sheeran. I'm a director of the Humanist Association of Ireland.
Hi, how are you? I'm Prasad, and I'm from India, working in the Sarvodaya movement, or the Gandhian movement.
Hello, my name is Roar Jonsson, and I'm president of the Norwegian Humanist Association, and you are listening to Humanist
Network News.
I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
And I'm your host, Duncan Crary.
Another speaker at the IHEU World Congress is Congressman Pete Stark, who's known for many things, including being the highest elected openly non-theistic official in the U.S.
Yeah, if you tack on enough categories, you can win anything, right?
That's right.
I caught up with Representative Stark at Harvard last year and asked him a little bit about how he felt being the highest elected openly non-theistic official in the United States. This was sort of right after the big media blitz about that story. So here's Congressman Stark.
Congressman Stark, you recently openly admitted in the press that you do not have a God belief. And I'm curious, have you embraced the term humanist?
No, I don't know as I've ever embraced any particular term. Somebody asked me what my beliefs were, and I said, I identify as a Unitarian who doesn't happen to believe in a supreme being, and that's about it as far as I've gone with it.
What are your thoughts on politicians wearing their religion on their sleeves?
Well, I don't mind if they wear it on their sleeves, just so they don't introduce it into legislation.
Do you think that separation of church and state is a very important issue in Congress today?
Not only in Congress, but it's getting to be a bigger issue in the world. The United States has relatively little affiliation between the religious and the secular life when you compare the rest of the world. And so while I think it's important here, it's going to be more important globally.
Do you think it's important for more politicians to be open about their religious beliefs if, say, they are atheists or non-religious?
I don't think politicians have any duty to do anything except deal with the political issues and their beliefs until their people are asked to vote what they believe relative to secular issues.
Just one follow-up to that. Ronald Reagan Jr. once said that because he's an atheist, the highest office he could hold, public office, would be dog catcher. What do you have to say to that?
Well, he ought to try Congress or the school board in Berkeley. The two of us have made it that way. So, no, I don't think that's correct. Some parts of the country, maybe in Kansas, that would hold, but certainly not in Boston and certainly not in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Representative Pete Stark, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Thank you.
One of the things I like to talk to our guests about is how they feel about identifying with certain labels. Of course, Pete Stark was speaking about that in the last clip. You know, it's one of the things that humanists like to talk about a lot, you know, whether you use a big H or a little H.
Absolutely.
Humanist, whether you call yourself an atheist, a free thinker, a bright, etc.
And this year at the Atheist Alliance International Conference, there's quite a big brouhaha, if you will, amongst some of the headliners of that conference, names such as Sam Harris, Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, and Daniel Dennett.
Yeah, Sam Harris had sort of posed the question to the audience of whether or not they should identify as atheist. Harris says he may be one of the most famous atheists in the world, but he doesn't want to identify by that label anymore.
That's right.
So I caught up with all the big names and I spoke to them about this. So here's a little taste of what they had to say.
Sam Harris, I think that of all the speakers and all the events that have occurred so far, you made news with your talk last night. You mentioned to the crowd that atheist as a label was it was a matter of convenience for you. People were labeling you as an atheist, and so you just said, okay, I'm an atheist. But you made a point about why you don't necessarily want to refer to yourself as an atheist. Could you recap that?
Sure.
Simply?
Sure. Yeah, well, I think it's a philosophical and a strategic error. I mean, as a matter of philosophy, atheism is not a worldview, and yet it is being construed as one by its opponents and attacked as a worldview. And people have many erroneous associations with what is entailed in not believing in God. And I think we collaborate in that misunderstanding by labeling ourselves in opposition to religion. We should notice that there are thousands, really an uncountable number of bad ideas that we all reject, and yet we don't label ourselves in opposition to them. It's something like astrology. We don't label ourselves non-astrologers. And I think we should take some instruction from that fact, because it would just be, what we're doing is we're falling into the a trap, in some sense, set by religious people, because atheism as a term is so ill-dignified in our culture, and so it has such bad PR that to answer to the name of atheist, in some sense, you already wins the argument for your religious opponent. It shouldn't be so, but I think we have to be wise and realize that we have a terrible PR problem, and so the question is what to do instead. And I think we can use words like reason and evidence and common sense instead. And in the same way that we would repudiate the views of astrologers if they were gaining great traction in our culture, with words like reason and evidence, we can do the same for claims about religion and, you know, the magic origin of certain books, etc.
Daniel Dennett, I think one of the most newsworthy aspects of the conference so far were some comments by Sam Harris last night. What are your general reactions to what Mr. Harris had to say?
Well, I think Sam's right that the term atheist is a risky term in some ways, because it minimizes and marginalizes what the real issue is, which is irrationality and just a failure to respect reason. Belief in God is just one aspect of that. And so if the only thing that people think they have to deal with is this question about whether we believe there exists a God, then we lose ground on that. On the other hand, we do need labels. We need some terms to describe ourselves, and I think that atheist is a good term. And we ought to work to rehabilitate the term in the eyes of many, along with other terms. I think that he's right that we should not just brandish the label as if that were the banner that we march under. That would be to play into their hands.
Professor Dawkins, I think some of the most provocative comments so far were made by Mr. Sam Harris last night. Do you have any reactions to some of his comments?
There are many people who object to the word atheist because they think it's provocative and puts people's backs up. And I think that's not what he was really talking about, or only very slightly. I think he was sort of saying that if you use the word atheist, you play into their hands in a way, and a better way to do it is to pick off, as it were with sniper fire, particular issues of irrationality, rather than say, I'm an atheist and I'm against all religion. It's a better political tactic, maybe, to say this particular thing is irrational. Opposition to stem cell research is irrational. Opposition to early term abortion is irrational. And go for each individual. Creationism is irrational. Intelligent design is irrational. Go for each individual one, picking them off, rather than say I'm an atheist, which then lays you vulnerable to being. To having to defend everybody who's ever been an atheist or whatever it might be. So that's different from saying that the word atheism is provocative and offensive. And I think he was making a very interesting point, and I'm still thinking about my reaction to it.
Okay. And though I know it's very unsatisfactory, I believe that the confrontation with the term is inescapable. In other words, one is going to be asked, either out of curiosity or out of hostility, are you an atheist? And the term has a common understanding that's shared by now a very, very large number of speakers of English and other languages too, where to say yes means I do not believe in a creator God or an intervening God. And thus, I think it's idle to expect that one can dodge the question as it will be presented in that form. And I'm perfectly content to say yes to that question in whatever tone of voice it is asked of me. I will add that, in fact, I'm an anti-theist. I don't just disbelieve in these propositions, but I think that the proposition is a horrible one. I'm glad it isn't true, glad there is no evidence for it. But I don't do this for purposes of spin or evasion. And I think any attempt to duck the question is doomed.
Christopher Hitchens, thank you for taking the time to speak with me.
Pleasure. Thank you for asking.
All right, Duncan. I feel like we've talked about all the serious aspects of humanism, but, you know, it can also be a very humorous topic. After all, humanists believe in having only one life to live, so, you know, why not enjoy that and laugh as much as you can?
Yeah, we should we try to have some fun on the show. At least Jess and I think that we're funny.
Absolutely.
So one of the most well-known people in the atheist humor circle is Julia Sweeney, who is a former actress on Saturday Night Live.
It's Pat.
Oh, yeah, who played the androgynous character, Pat. You could never tell if it was a guy or a girl. And Jess and I caught up with Miss Sweeney down in New York City right before her one-woman show, Letting Go of God. Here's Julia Sweeney.
In some ways, people expect an atheist organization to have oddballs, so you're already coming in with a preconceived notion that there are going to be oddballs there. And I always was such a lover of being involved with churches that, to me, those people that you might term oddballs, I love them. You know, like, to me, that's just the spice of the organization. On the other hand, I will say that just being an atheist is a person, the type of personality who's willing to say that they're an atheist is a person who doesn't mind being not aligned with the mainstream of society. And there are also people that don't necessarily join groups at all. Like, so they're kind of in this group, but they're really not group type people. And I think that makes it hard for atheist organizations to keep groups together, because just the very type of profile of a person who would be an atheist is by nature a person who doesn't join groups. So, but I love them. I love them. I mean, to me, these are my peeps.
And Jess, I think that one of the funniest segments we ever had on our show was your interview with Mr. Deity.
That's right. I love that one.
Mr. Deity, for those of you who don't know, it's a very, very popular online TV show, right? Yes. And video podcast.
Yep.
Featuring three actors portraying the life of the deity himself and Jesse, who's sort of the Jesus character, and Larry who's like the Holy Ghost or something.
I guess so, yeah. The Father, the Son, the Holy Ghost, yeah.
So here's a little bit of Jess's conversation with Mr. Deity.
Mr. Deity, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to speak with me on behalf of humanists and people in the world in general.
Well, you know, all I have is time, so.
I have a couple questions about, you know, your master plan and some of the decisions that you've made. We might as well start at the beginning, I guess. Can you explain the whole rib thing to me? I mean, did the first woman really come from the first man's extra rib bone?
Well, the rib was the foundation, and then we built around it. You know, you have to have some basic DNA, so we took it from there. And we just kind of, you know, built the remaining structure around that. And I'll tell you, Adam wasn't happy with it because it was, you know, this is back before the days of anesthesia. So very painful for him.
And so it was then choosing women to bear the responsibility of reproducing your way of sort of balancing out the power?
Well, I just felt like I couldn't put Adam through any more pain at that point. So, you know, I'd already taken a rib. What am I going to do? You know what I mean? Plus, he didn't really have the correct anatomy. I could have shot it out the back end, the kid, but, you know, just not cool.
No, probably not. Was Mary really a virgin?
That whole case has been sealed. I am not allowed to talk about it by court order. And that's all I can say at this point. That's, you know, I'd love to talk more about it, but because of the settlement, you know, the whole child support thing and whatnot, I just can't say.
Could you at least tell me, like, whose name did you yell?
You know, I generally yell out Zeus. I mean, if you knew the guy, you'd love him as much as I do. You know, he's a good guy, always been there for me, very helpful. So, you know, that's my preferred name. Oh, Zeus. Oh, Zeus. That's basically how it goes for me.
Can I quote you there?
You can quote me.
This is Pastor Deacon Fred from the Landover Baptist Church, and you're listening to the Humanist Network News. And I'll tell you what, you either shut this thing off right now, you're going to burn in hell.
Who let that guy on the show, Jez?
Well, that was Pastor Deacon Fred, right?
Of course. The His Highness. Yeah, he's a pretty funny guy, Pastor. It's not serious, folks. It's all a shtick.
No, but anytime he wants to come on our podcast, he's welcome to, right? If you'd like to peruse through our archives on humaniststudies.org/podcast, please feel free to do so. You'll hear from comedian Jamila Bay and some funny cartoonists, Jeff Swenson, Matt Bors, and Michaela Reed, who also appear weekly on our Humanist Network News Easy.
Oh, yeah. You can read their cartoons in our cathartic comic sections.
That's my favorite part.
That one interview with all three cartoonists, they were discussing the Muhammad cartoon controversy from the perspective of cartoonists.
So the most serious topic that we could talk about.
Yeah, like. Yeah. We took some really funny people and asked them some really serious stuff. I love Jeff Swenson's cartoon that he did after the Muhammad controversy, though. It was Muhammad looking into the mirror, shaving, going, blasphemy! So.
Nice. Now, another topic that we've had some fun with on our show.
Yeah.
Is
S-E-X.
That's right.
Yeah, we actually have had a couple segments on sex, and we did answer the age-old question. You know, if atheists don't believe in God,
then who do they call out when they're in bed?
Yeah, whose name do they call out? So here's a clip from a naughty little radio play we put on at the Institute.
Hello. What did we discuss about using the word God in the bedroom? I'm an atheist and, you know, I don't care to hear that name yelled while I'm making love.
Yes, but I'm a deist and it doesn't bother me.
Come on, can't you think of something different to yell besides, oh God? Try words that embrace the natural world.
Seems to me you're being picky, but I'll try. Oh, yeah. Oh, I mean, oh, Mother Nature.
Mother Nature? That's the best you could come up with?
This isn't easy.
And now I have an image of a prune-faced hag with saggy tits stuck in my head.
What am I supposed to say?
I said the natural world, not mythology.
All right. Oh, Darwin. Oh, theory of natural selection. Oh, genetic drift.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Baby.
Oh, misunderstood, punctuated, equilibrium.
Oh, you're making me so hot.
But seriously, folks, sex, sexuality, and medically based sex education are all very serious issues to us humanists. And we even spoke with sex therapist or sex psychologist Dr. Marty Klein about some various issues around sex. All right, Duncan, that was probably one of your favorite interviews.
It certainly was. Here's Dr. Klein.
We live in a culture where it's very difficult for people to say, honey, I love you until the end of time, and I want to devote myself to you emotionally. I just don't want to be sexually exclusive. It's very difficult for people in North America today to look someone in the eye and say that without having some dreadful repercussions. And so what most people do is they just do what they want and they hide what they're doing, you know, which is not a very good solution, although it's the most common solution. The other thing that people do with monogamy is that they are, in fact, sexually exclusive, but they're resentful or they're resigned to a life that they don't really want.
Another issue that's very important to humanists is equality for same-sex couples. And actually, many humanists are organizing the movement based on the successes of the gay rights movement. And we discuss this issue relatively often on the program. So Jess actually recorded a wonderful little conversation among among three lesbians about their experiences coming out.
I came out to my sister, who proceeded to say, I'm going to tell Mom. And I said, okay, well, the Grand Ole Opry's on. I walked into Mom and I said, I know you're watching a show right now, but I need to tell you something. I said, June and I aren't friends. We're sleeping together. If you have any questions, come talk to me after the Opry. And she just kind of looked up at me and was like, uh-huh, and looked back at the Opry, and then I was just out from then.
That's so interesting when you say what you said to your mother. When I told my mother, she started going through all my friends that she had met. She said, please don't tell me you're a lesbian. I said, okay, I won't tell you I'm a lesbian. Then she goes, is Melissa a lesbian? I said, uh-huh. Is Sue a lesbian? Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Is Barbara a lesbian? Uh-huh. So everyone that she named, I just kept going, uh-huh, uh-huh. And yeah, that was it. There was never any other discussion about it afterwards.
This is Margaret Downey, president of the Atheist Alliance International, and you're listening to Humanist Network News.
I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
And I'm your host, Duncan Crary.
Folk singer Holly Neer wrote the theme song for the Humanist Network News podcast called I Ain't Afraid. She's well known for her gay rights activism, but here's what she had to tell us about fighting for all different kinds of causes.
Well, I don't believe in causes. I think that we are holistic people. We have arms and legs, and if you only struggle for arms, you kind of leave your legs out of the picture. And so I've always felt like as I learned something else, when I first learned about wanting to be against war, and then I learned about feminism, and then I learned about gay and lesbian rights, and I learned about the environment, and I learned about immigration, and I learned about the prison system, and instead of running from one cause to another, I just keep putting that information into my toolbox as if I were in the university of life and I'm heading for a PhD. I just want to keep bringing it all into my library, and it makes me a more holistic, interesting person, and it makes me capable of appreciating other people better the more I know. And so folks who just focus on one thing, I mean, there are certain times when I think it's really important to take on an issue and we only have so much energy and put your energy into it. But gay people come in all colors. They come from all countries. And so you can't really be for gay rights and not think about what's happening to someone who's in Rwanda. I mean, how do you separate that? Are we only for gay rights of people who are in white, middle, upper middle class United States? Well, that's not a gay rights movement. And if you're working on racism, but you don't include gay people, then you only want freedom from racism for people who are heterosexuals? You know, I mean, you can't break us up into little pieces like that, as much as people try. And I'm just unwilling to be chopped up into little pieces.
Yeah, I don't remember anymore. Temporary reprieve, and the world might cease if we fail to tame the beast. From the faith that you release comes in atheist peace.
Okay, that's not actually Holly Neer's music we were just listening to. That's punk rocker Greg Graffin and the band Bad Religion. We like to interview lots of musicians about their ideas about humanism, and here's what punk rocker Greg Graffin had to say.
We started Bad Religion when we were only 15 years old, and at that stage in life, the word humanism and even the ideas of science were not very forefront in our minds. We were mostly interested in rabble-rousing and being rebellious. And so the term itself, Bad Religion, came about because we just wanted to make people angry at us, basically. And at that time, the right-wing Christian movement was getting stronger and stronger in America. And it was around 1980, and there were a lot of conservative televangelists on television. And we thought, what better target than that to call a bad religion? And then it dawned on us, even at a young age, that it's kind of an ironic name, because we started to amass a following, and we thought we ourselves are kind of representative of a bad religion. So it ended up being a very appropriate name, and something that, as we got older, we didn't have to shy away from, because religion is such a eternal topic for conversation.
The product of God and the lie is Osama bin Laden, George Bush, Saddam Hussein, just bottling problems, sticking dirty rags in the top and lighting the bottoms, holding it with a smile to throw it into the crowd, a cloud. It's bigger than George Bush and Osama, or if we ready for a black president named Obama. I'm trying to fight my own indoctrination. They think they can stop an atheist by saying he's praying to Satan. Oh yeah.
That clip you just heard was by rapper Graydon Swear, another previous guest that we've had on our show.
Jess, you also interviewed like some religious techno-Christian emo musicians too.
Yes, the Rational Right, maybe, or the Right Rapture, something like that.
Yeah, the Rapture Right, I think.
Yeah.
Okay, moving from music, we do speak to a lot of literary types, and we're going to mix this up, though. This is actually Salman Rushdie asking a question for our audio humanist advice column, Sweet Reason, which is produced by Maline Matsumara. Salman Rushdie, I have one final question for you. I know you have to go. Humanist Network News publishes what we think is the only advice column for humanists, questions about life as a humanist. And I'm wondering if you have a question for our Sweet Reason humanist advice columnist. Any issues that you might want to ask about?
You mean that kind of agony aunt?
Yes, an agony aunt.
Well, I think one of the problems that I've felt is the lack of a language in which to speak about these things, because religious language is so highly developed and has had, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years to establish itself. And non-religious language sometimes feels impoverished. And the question is, where do we go to develop that language? You know, that how do we get the right words? You know, for instance, if you're a person who doesn't believe in an afterlife, a word like the soul would seem to have no meaning, you know? And yet, many of us, whether or not we believe in paradise or a god or an immortal side to ourselves, understand what we mean by the soul. So the question is how to create a language that works. Ask your agony aunt that.
Well, we did ask, and here's what Sweet Reason had to say.
Trust Salman Rushdie to ask a question like that. I think you've articulated something that bothers a lot of people. But I'm going to have to disagree with you. It's hard to see the direction of a historical change when you're living through it, but we're in the middle of one that has been going on for hundreds of years. Non-religious language has grown richer, and it's still evolving. And with the spread of literacy and modern communications, the change can only go faster. Terms that used to be religious now have entirely different meanings. If I say fast food heaven, you don't think of angels and halos. You think of fish and chips. If I call someone a saint, you're not going to think I mean they've been canonized by the Catholic Church. You'll know I simply mean a really good person. June Calwood, the famous Canadian social activist, was nicknamed Saint June, and she was an atheist. Slang has taken the process so far that in the days before pop-top cans, Americans called beer can openers church keys. Ecstasy used to mean mystic contemplation of the divine. Now it's the name of a drug. I'm talking about the English language because it's the only language I speak fluently. But I'm sure listeners can think of equivalent examples in other languages. At the same time this has been going on, the religious monopoly on the language of morality and inspiration has been broken. Artists and philosophers, along with ordinary people, are actively reclaiming the language of values. For example, in his poem Howl, Alan...
And Duncan, you got the chance to interview two of your favorite authors on two very different topics.
I did. That would be James Howard Kunstler and Dr. Richard Selzer. For those of you who don't know, James Howard Kunstler is a social critic, and he authored the book The Geography of Nowhere. I brought him on our show to talk about the human habitat, that is the built environment that we live in, an issue that should be very important to humanists. So here's a little bit of what Kunstler had to say.
One of the great tragedies of the last, of the beginning of the 21st century is that our economy became about little more than building suburban sprawl. And this is an enormous problem because suburban sprawl is a living arrangement with no future.
Mm-hmm.
And you can state that categorically. And so what our economy has become is, an organism devoted to building more stuff that has no future.
And here's Dr. Richard Selzer reading from his book, Mortal Lessons, about surgery and humanism.
Listen to the neurosurgeon. Patty, buzz, suck, cut, he says. Then suck, cut, patty, buzz. It is as simple as a nursery rhyme. The surgeon knows the landscape of the brain, yet does not know how a thought is made. Man has grown envious of this mystery. He would master and subdue it electronically. He would construct a computer to rival or surpass the brain. He would harness Europa's bull to a plow. There are men who implant electrodes into the brain, that part where anger is kept, the rage center, they call it. They press a button, and a furious bull halts in mid-charge and lopes amiably to nuzzle his matador. Anger has turned to sweet compliance. Others sever whole tracts of brain cells with their knives to mollify the insane. Here is surgery grown violent as rape. These men cannot know the brain. They have not the heart for it. I last saw the brain in the emergency room. I wiped it from the shoulder of a young girl to make her smashed body more presentable to her father. Now I stand with him by the stretcher. We are arm in arm like brothers. All at once, there is that terrible silence of discovery. I glance at him, follow his gaze, and see that there is more brain upon her shoulder, newly slipped from the cracked skull. He bends forward a bit. He must make certain it is her brain. I watch the knowledge expand upon his face, so like hers. I, too, stare at the fragment, flung wetly, now drying beneath the bright lights of the emergency room, its cargo of thoughts evaporating from it, mingling for this little time with his, with mine, before dispersing in the air.
Well, folks, that about wraps up our show for this month.
Our whirlwind tour of the Humanist Network News podcast. We hope that we maybe enticed you to listen to more programs. And there's a lot of other interesting topics that we didn't get to speak about today. We've talked to guests about comic book superheroes and humanism.
That's right.
And religion.
We talked about geomythology, which is what, Duncan?
Oh, a very interesting topic, linking actual paleontological discoveries with the ancient myths like of the Cyclops and the Griffin. You'd be surprised the connection between those two, but I'll let you listen to it for yourself.
Another serious topic, which would be suicide terrorism.
Yeah, the psychology of suicide terrorism. Jess, another thing that we love to do on our program is play listener comments from all the folks out there listening to HNN. You can even call in and ask a question for our advice columnist, Sweet Reason, but I can never remember the phone number. What is it, Jess?
You really can't, Duncan. It's 1-866-659-1515.
And you can send us email at editor@humaniststudies.org if you'd prefer. The use of our theme music was generously donated to us by Holly Near. You can learn more at hollynear.com. And you can visit us online anytime and download past programs or read transcripts at humaniststudies.org/podcast or americanhumanist.org/podcast.
You've been listening to the Humanist Network News Podcast,
the official podcast of the American Humanist Association.
I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
And I'm your host, Duncan Crary. And we're going to leave you with some words by the late Rabbi Sherwin Wein, a leader of the Society for Humanistic Judaism, speaking about humanism and spirituality. Thanks a lot for listening.
Thanks, folks.
One of the things that you do in the celebration of humanism is you talk about the human condition. And what we all know is that the human condition is absurd. No, I mean, that you celebrate the absurdity of the human condition. So people often ask me, well, what's your substitute for worshiping God? You worship people. Never. Never. And the alternative to worship for me has always been something I've treasured. It's laughter. What I want to do first is to give you the question, because frequently you hear answers and you can't figure out the question. All right. If you're trying to reach the Chinese, if you're trying to reach the Indian, do you understand? If you're trying to reach the secularized Christian world, I'd mentioned this to Salman Rushdie. I love the idea of atheism mass or atheist mass or whatever you call it. All right. You mentioned it last night, but it won't work because what happens is most secular Christians do Christmas. Do you know that? They rearrange it. They reinterpret it. Whatever else it is, they do that because it's connected to their mother, their father, their grandmother. You can't sever people from their ancestors. You may try, and there will always be that group that doesn't care. So the question is it possible to have a secular Judaism, a secular Christianity, a secular Islam, a secular Hinduism, Professor Sen spoke, a secular, this Confucianism is the fundamental, right, background to Chinese culture, a kind of secular Confucianism. I mean, can you have these things? Can you retain your ancestral connection and preserve your integrity? The balancing between continuity and, right? It's a balancing act, always. For some people, they don't want continuity. They just want the integrity. For some people, they're willing to sacrifice the integrity to have the what? The continuity. So they'll say things they don't believe because they want the comfort of the continuity. And so we're in this delicate, always balancing act between the two. And so that's my answer. And the answer, I think, of most humanistic Jews to the question. The question is it possible not to have an adversarial relationship to the cultures of the past, to view the religious systems of the past not only as religions, but to view them as cultures? Got the question? Got my answer? You've been wonderful. Thank you so much.
Humanist Network News is an audio production of the Institute for Humanist Studies, a nonprofit think tank that promotes the philosophy of humanism. Learn more at humaniststudies.org.